Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The U.S. Department of Justice now is required to obtain a warrant before using a certain method to collect cell phone data. That is, unless there's an emergency. Privacy advocates applaud the change, but it raises the issue of the murky world of government surveillance. Associate Technology Editor Robinson Meyer recently wrote about the issue in The Atlantic. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Robinson Meyer.
Excellent. Thanks for having me, Ann.
You wrote that a few weeks ago, the state of cell phone tracking became slightly more confusing, which is never a good sign for me. So how so?
Yeah, so as you were saying, the Department of Justice announced that it would impose certain rules on the use of stingrays, which are these third-party devices that can figure out where a cell phone is located, like in physical space, and also monitor which numbers that phone is calling. And the DOJ said that it would now require a warrant to use those. It would require federal agents to get a warrant before using stingrays. It would impose certain limits on how long they could keep the data. But that, first of all those rules would be off in the case of an emergency, and also that none of those rules affected state or local police departments, both of which we know do use stingrays on a fairly regular basis.
What prompted this change at the federal level?
We don't really know. I would say that there is kind of two trends going on. The first is that the Obama administration seems to be imposing more rules on surveillance and more kind of guidelines for surveillance and for other government powers as it reaches its end. And the other one is that there's just been more focus on stingrays and similar police kind of surveillance technology recently, due to a history, like a very recent history of court victories and news stories, and those I think have finally moved the parts of the government that supported regulation and securing a warrant to actually put those rules in place.
So the U.S. Justice Department now needs a warrant to pursue certain types of cell phone data collection. You're referring specifically to these third-party devices called stingrays. How much does that affect overall cell phone surveillance by the government?
It affects it in certain ways. The stingray is the only surveillance tool. The stingray and similar devices are the only surveillance tools that can pinpoint where a cell phone is in physical space. So right now, under those new rules, the federal government really only has one way to find out where a cell phone is located, and that is now under warrant. That will now require a warrant. The government has lots of other ways to surveil cell phones, though. Mm-hmm. They can do it by asking the phone company. They can do it by getting a warrant and then injecting software onto a device remotely. And none of those other ways are now subject to requiring a warrant, and there's fewer rules around them, really.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about government surveillance of cell phones. My guest is Robinson Meyer. He's Associate Technology Editor at The Atlantic. We'll have a link to his recent article about this issue on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. So what qualifies as an emergency that would eliminate the need for a warrant by the federal government to use this kind of device?
Yeah, it's a little ill-defined. It's
figures.
A threat. It's a threat to national security. They usually put under there, mm-hmm. or an immediate threat to life. So often kidnappings,
yeah.
Or hostage situations, they'll circumvent warrant rules. And then also kind of anything that would be considered a terrorism threat, this kind of big national security level threat, they would absolutely go around the need for a warrant there.
You mentioned that there's two ways law enforcement can go after cell phone data, through the phone companies or by itself using the stingray, as we've been talking about. What's more common? Was this stingray device approach the lesser of the two, or do we not necessarily know?
In some ways, we don't necessarily know just because we know so little about how much stingrays are used. I would say that it sure seems like stingrays were the least common way, but that's only because the primary way that law enforcement surveils cell phones, which is going through the cell phone companies, is so common. You know, we know that happens tens of thousands of times per year on a national level. So police departments kind of all levels are doing this many times per day. What you see in the city departments, the kind of best numbers we have is that they're using their stingray maybe once or twice per day. Mm-hmm. And so it is the least common way, but that's because the getting what's called cell site location information, where they basically get a list of what cell towers a certain phone has connected to, is mm-hmm. so common.
All right. So how does it work when phone companies cooperate? How does that process take place?
Yeah, so there are a couple ways that phone companies cooperate, and they all come back to that idea of cell site location information, which is basically that whenever your phone, gets a text or makes a call, it registers a record with the phone company that says, hey, you know, it connected to this cell tower, and it connected like in the north quadrant or the east quadrant or the south quadrant. And if you put that together for, a certain phone number, and you can follow, you know, a string of check-ins or a string of phone calls, you can basically see a route someone's taking through triangulation and mm-hmm. others. Right now, police can get historical versions of that data. So just say, like, give me give me 3 months of that data for this cell phone number. They can get that just by filing a request with the phone company. They don't need a warrant. They don't need to meet the high standard of proof that a warrant requires. Basically, they just say to a judge, hey, please help us get this kind of information. The judge needs to find out they have a very low level of suspicion, and then they sign off, they send it to the phone company, and often these phone companies have online portals to make getting that kind of information really easy.
But if you have to go to a judge, isn't that a warrant?
It's not. There's two different kinds of, you can get basically like a court order.
Okay.
Which doesn't require, it's not a warrant because it doesn't need to meet Fourth Amendment levels of scrutiny. Mm-hmm. Basically, there's a difference the law makes between reasonable suspicion, which is what you need for a warrant, and then just kind of like suspicion. And you only need to meet the suspicion, which has a legal name, which is eluding me at the moment. But you only need to meet that suspicion requirement, mm-hmm. like if you say, hey, this seems plausible, and the judge. You know, judges often can get rid of that non-warrant. They can, like, dispatch that non-warrant request in, like, 30, 45 seconds. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very low standard of proof.
Okay, so currently a warrant isn't needed to collect historical cell site location information, but the courts don't all agree on this, and you wrote that it might be headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. What are the arguments?
That's right. So There is disagreement basically over whether you need a warrant to get a lot of historical cell site information. You know, cops will go and they'll ask for 3 months, they'll ask for 6 months, and they'll just get it. The argument is basically over whether there's this concept in federal privacy law, which is called the third party doctrine. And that is, if you're sharing information with a third party, like a bank or a phone company, you don't expect that information to be private because you're already sharing it. Lawyers on the government side say that the third party doctrine applies here. You know that you're sharing this information when you use your cell phone. And so therefore you just don't expect privacy. What privacy advocates and criminal justice reform advocates say is that cell site information and kind of the whole set of data which your phone creates and transmits to the phone company, which can then be, you know, requested by the government, is much more data than existed when the third-party doctrine came into being in the 1970s. It's not just a phone number. It's not just a bank account number, which are, you know, two kinds of information that Americans know they're creating when they place a call or, mm-hmm. or send money through the system. It's location data. It's possibly, you know, how much battery the phone had. It's where the phone was physically located. All that additional information, they say, goes way beyond what the third-party doctrine was meant to control. Most Americans don't know they're creating it, and so it should be subject to a warrant.
Well, I would imagine, I mean, if I get an app and it asks me to sign off on all kinds of, you know, access to information, I have a choice there. I'm like, no, 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 no.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And then they say, well, sorry, the app won't work then, but whatever. But you know, that it has changed a lot. We, in other things, we have a choice.
That's right. And I would say something, too, that these advocates argue is that for cell phones to work, we really don't have a choice in creating this kind of information. This kind of data is just created almost as an exhaust process of just having a phone in the cell system. But because it's so further reaching than the kind of data that you created just by like placing a phone call in 1978 or 1979, it should be subject to more to a higher standard of privacy.
Now, the limits don't apply to local and state law enforcement. You said that's a big deal. And as I'm talking to you, I'm getting the sense about what a bonanza the explosion of cell phone use must have been for law enforcement.
Yeah, it's really insane. The number of different ways, you know, of course, we're talking about this article I wrote, which is like, here's a primer on all the different ways the government can surveil your cell phone. And then at the end, still, I have to like insert a clause that's like, well, you know, they could also do this thing or this thing. And we actually don't really know because historically, our, you know, civilian understanding of what the government is doing to look at cell phones has so lagged behind what the government is actually doing. But yes, the number of ways that even local police departments have been able to get suspect data is just so much bigger than it was even before the smartphone era began in 2007.
And what about the phone companies? Do they have any trepidation about providing this kind of information?
You know, the willingness of phone companies to cooperate with government surveillance is really, really interesting. The Intercept, which is Glenn Greenwald's publication, did a big story earlier this year about how basically AT&T is super complicit in this, how it is the friendliest of providers to the government. It has installed a lot of hardware and software that they asked that other phone companies have resisted. You know, generally across cell providers, though, the feeling is they don't really have a choice, that the government will fight, you know, individual expensive legal fights to set precedent that they have to turn this over. And so, therefore, until there's a case which says that the government needs a warrant to get especially the cell site location information, it's not worth it to them to fight it. They also put in those documents you sign when you become a customer, they often put in that privacy policy, something like that if law enforcement asks, they'll turn over certain types of data. And one of the most interesting things about the court ruling earlier this year, which is the ruling which could send the whole cell site location information question to the Supreme Court, one of the interesting things about that ruling is the judge there said that those privacy policies don't apply. That they don't have enough legal standing to circumvent the need for a warrant.
So even though you're signing that away, that's still not good enough.
Exactly. The judge said that the Constitution requires a higher level of a higher standard than just signing those rights away in a contract.
Even though we all read all of that fine print before
that's right. Even though every time you sign a business document, especially with a big company, you read all 35 pages or whatever, or before you press the, like, I agree on the
exactly.
end user license agreement, right?
Oh, man. Well, lots to talk about. Not enough time, but I appreciate your time today, Robinson Meyer.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. I hope I made it a little more clear.
Yeah, you did. Thanks a lot. Robinson Meyer, he's Associate Technology Editor at The Atlantic. We'll have a link to his article about government surveillance of our cell phones on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We hear it all the time. Robots and automation are taking our jobs. Humans are being replaced by machines. But some believe that uniquely human abilities will go out of style in the workplace. Will never go out of style in the workplace. Fortune Senior Editor-at-Large Jeff Colvin has written on the topic. His new book is entitled, Humans Are Underrated, What High Achievers Know That Brilliant Machines Never Will. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Jeff Colvin.
Thank you, Ann. Glad to be with you.
So, first of all, never is a long time for brilliant machines not to know more than us. What do you mean by that?
That's a great question, and here's what I mean. It's not really a question. Yes, here's my own subtitle, and so now I'm going to quibble with it. it's not really a question of what they know. It's a question of what they are able to do with us. And what this really comes down to is we humans are hardwired from our evolutionary history to interact with other humans in a certain way. That's very, very deep. In fact, it's so deep that we don't consciously realize everything that's going on when we interact in person, face to face, with another human being. But it is a very deep and powerful process. And that's the process we evolved to have. So even if a brilliant machine can detect our emotions, which, by the way, they can do, and in some cases can do better than we can do it, and even if they can express emotions, which they are now beginning to do, it still isn't good enough. We want to have that experience with another human being and only with another human being, and that's the only way the magic happens. And the ability to do that, the ability to interact with other human beings, those are going to be the high-value skills as technology takes over more and more of everything else.
So if you have a good personality but are crummy at math?
There's hope.
Okay.
There's look, and there's nothing wrong with being good at math.
No, not at all.
You know, that's for sure. And so we need to be clear on this. You know, all the advice that kids hear and their parents hear is that we should focus on STEM education, mm-hmm. science, technology, engineering, and math subjects. And that's good advice, but it needs some fine-tuning, because what I'm hearing from real employers out there is that someone who can just do the STEM subjects, who can just sit in a room and write software, for example, if that's all they can do, but they're not empathetic, they're not collaborative, they don't have the deep interpersonal skills, then that person's going to be a low-value employee. The high-value employee is going to be the one who can do the engineering or coding or whatever it may be and has the deep interpersonal skills. That's going to be the differentiator.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, where there's hope for the rest of us. If you have a good personality and can manage technology going forward, you have a better chance in the workplace than those who may be brilliant and with technology, but don't know how to interact with other humans. My guest is Jeff Colvin. He's the author of a new book. It's called Humans are underrated. What high achievers know that brilliant machines never will. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You observe that in general, humans are obsessed with the idea that robots will eventually become like us, only better. Where does that obsession come from? Really good science fiction?
Well, yeah, for one thing, it comes from really good science fiction. But it comes all, and by the way, I think I counted at least 5 Hollywood movies this year based on that premise. But it comes also from seeing what's happening in the real world that is reaching a point where it really worries a lot of ordinary people. When you see computers doing stuff that you never thought would be possible, the most obvious example being driving a car, how could this possibly be? You know, think of the judgments you have to make. Think of all the sensory inputs that come into you when you're driving a car. Well, computers are doing it, and they're not only doing it, they're doing it better than we are. They're better drivers than humans are. We see computers taking over a lot of the, well, some of the work in law offices. They're doing work that lawyers used to get paid a lot of money to do, reading documents in the discovery phase of a lawsuit, for example. And again, they do it not only faster and cheaper, but also better than human lawyers do. We're even seeing some early work being done now in autonomous robotic surgery. That is, robots that will perform surgery entirely on their own. And right now, this is being focused on very simple subtasks, such as identifying cancerous tissue and cutting it out. But I've spoken to people in the industry, and they have no doubt that in 10 or 20 years, computers will do surgery on their own.
But if I want to talk to somebody about my surgery, I don't want to talk to the robot that is going to perform it.
You have gone straight to the heart of it. That is exactly right. And that is going to be the distinction between the high-value doctor and the low-value doctor. And indeed, there is research, it's fascinating research, that simple human interaction between patient and robot, between patient and doctor can have real therapeutic medical benefits. People actually get better faster if their doctor is more empathetic. It's not just making people, you know, feel better subjectively. They really get better. So it's a true high value skill.
You use an example. I think it was in an article you wrote, maybe for The Atlantic, about the IT guy. And we've all been around. If you've been around since the 80s, you know, the IT guys could be pretty mostly they were guys.
Yes.
And they first asked you if you plugged it in or not. And with that kind of, you know, rolling their eyes
rolling
kind
their
of
eyes.
A thing. Yeah. And we've all had that. Now, IT guys are getting a lot better.
Right.
I mean, they are. And I wonder, is this already something that companies are paying attention to?
Well, it is what some companies are paying attention to, and more of them are. So the story, one story you may have thought of that I did tell in an article, which was in Fortune, actually, was... it's a story that was told to me by the chief of HR at Southwest Airlines, who said they had hired a high-level HR guy, of course, and you know, with excellent credentials. And after he'd been there about a week, the HR chief ran into him and said, so how's it going? How you doing? And the guy responded, people here are strange. They want to talk to me in the hallway, and they ask how I'm doing, and they really want to know. And I just want to go back to my cube and work. And so this is kind of like the stereotype IT guy. But at Southwest, it's a real problem because they have this culture which they guard ferociously. And it's a culture of friendliness, sense of humor. Yeah, you know, people do want to talk to each other in the hallway, and they really do care, and they like to tell a joke. And if there's somebody in the company who doesn't have that, It's a real problem. Even one person is a real problem. And so ultimately they decided this guy had to go. And he did. They showed him the door. And even though he had those credentials, he didn't have the human qualities that the company requires. And we're seeing more and more of that. This happened some years ago at Southwest, but I have since heard similar stories from people at other companies.
You know, I recently interviewed somebody from one of the big utilities down in Louisiana after Katrina hit, and what their work involved, and so much of it involved human contact.
Right, right. And you know, no one should be surprised. You know, this is what it's all about. As long as humans are making the decisions, this is what it's all about, because it's the way we are. I mean, I was talking recently with a group of financial advisors. Now, financial advice, the nuts and bolts of it, is increasingly moving to computers. Computers can analyze the data, analyze more data more thoroughly than any human being ever could. And yet, the financial advisor still has an important job, because people are emotional about financial decisions. Sometimes they get irrational about financial decisions. I don't want to shock anybody by saying this, but you know, I suspect we all understand it. The role of the financial advisor is to make that human connection with the person who needs help.
The question is, how will humans add value? What does that mean on the ground? Is, like I said, is it a good personality? What do we mean by that?
Well, that's a great question, because we have to get specific about this. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't just tell people to, you know, be good with people. What does it mean? The answer is becoming clear. The foundational skill is empathy. And empathy doesn't just mean feeling someone else's pain. It means discerning what another person is feeling and thinking, whatever it may be, and then responding in some appropriate way. And once a person can do that, then everything else becomes much more possible. Collaborating, solving problems creatively together. The ability to do that is incredibly important, because all of our big problems now are being solved by teams, by groups. They're complex. They're too much for one person. So they're all being solved by teams and groups. And there's this remarkable research on the effectiveness of teams, which says that most of the factors we thought were critical to team effectiveness really aren't. It's not the IQ of the team. It's not the cohesion or the motivation of the team. The most important factor is the average level of social sensitivity among the team members. That is, how well they can sense what the other team members are thinking and feeling. And that enables the team to get more ideas from everybody out onto the table, and enables the team to arrive at a collective judgment on the good ideas and the bad ideas fairly efficiently.
You know, I wonder who's got it harder right now, the people that bring these qualities to the workplace or the people in the workplace that have to find these people?
Yeah, yeah. That's a really good question, because these qualities are not always highly valued, or traditionally have not always been highly valued. And so even people who are good at these skills may actually suppress them in the workplace, mm-hmm. because they think, this is not going to get me ahead. I have to focus on something else. And so there's a real transition. It's a real adjustment that's taking place in a lot of organizations, where everyone has to acknowledge that actually these skills are valuable, and we explicitly have to look for them and encourage them, and even help people develop them, which can be done.
There must be some people who will still lose whose skills still will lose importance in this process.
Yes.
What skills are the most at risk for obsolescence at this stage of the game?
You're absolutely right. We've seen a lot of that, and we're going to see more. The skills that are most in danger of obsolescence are the skills, the jobs, we should say, that don't involve any human interaction. There are still quite a lot of jobs in the economy that really don't require a person to have any interaction or any significant interaction with another person. And we can just about guarantee that eventually technology is going to do those jobs faster and cheaper and better than humans. So when you look at all of the people who had jobs of transactions, checkout clerks at stores, bank tellers, people who check you in at the airport, a lot of that work was really machine work, but people were doing it. Well, people are not doing it anymore because the machines do it better. So any job of that kind is at great risk. And, you know, if I always tell people, if you don't have a job that requires those skills or that could benefit from those skills, then you better be thinking of what you're going to do next, because this isn't going to last.
And an interesting observation you made about people who drive semi-trucks and people who deliver things.
Yeah. Truck driver is the number one job held by men in the United States, about 2.9 million. Well, that job is going away. It will take a little while, but the first self-driving semi-trucks are being tested right now in Nevada, and they're being developed by Mercedes and being tested by one of the big trucking companies. I can't remember which one, but they are being tested right now, and we can see where this is going to go. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no question about it. Well, when you think about that, that, you know, the number one job held by men is mostly going to disappear. It's a sobering prospect.
Okay. Well, Jeff Colvin, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it. I guess I'm okay.
You're okay for a long time. You know, it'll be a long time before anybody can do what you can do. And by the way, so who is going to do well? First of all, I'm a big fan of liberal arts education. STEM education is great, but I really do believe the world is moving towards liberal arts graduates. You know, they've been told that the world is moving away from them. I don't believe it. The world is now moving toward them. The other thing is that the research is very clear when it comes to these skills of deep human interaction. On average, women are just better. There's a ton of research on this, but do we really need the research? Don't we all know just from life that that's true? And it is.
All right. Well, Jeff Colvin, thanks again. Really appreciate your time today.
My pleasure.
Jeff Colvin, he's the author of Humans Are Underrated, What High Achievers Know That Brilliant Machines Never Will. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last week, Apple hosted a special event to showcase its new line of upgraded gadgets. Of course, there were new iterations of the iPhone and the iPad, but the people at Apple had a few other things up their sleeves as well. Joining us now is AndroidCentral.com contributing editor, Russell Holley. Hi, Russell.
Hello.
So, Apple just showcased their new iPhone, the 6S. What makes the 6S different from the 6? Besides the S.
A couple of things.
Yeah.
usually an S release is kind of incremental, which means the outside doesn't change a whole lot, but the inside changes a bunch. And that was true with this release as well. What we got was a slightly different battery, a significant improvement to the camera. We've gone from an 8-megapixel sensor to a 12-megapixel sensor that can pull in a little more light and do some pretty clever things when it comes to shooting video and pictures. And I've not gotten to try some of those yet, but the ideas behind them have been pretty good. And Apple is usually really good when it comes to their camera. So I'm pretty hopeful that that's going to be exciting stuff. And they've also implemented what they're calling 3D touch on the screen of the phone. It uses technology that we've seen in the Apple Watch and in the new MacBook that was released earlier this year, where you know, you have your basic press events where you know, like you use an iPhone now where you tap things and things happen. But there will be a whole lot of things where you'll be able to tap and hold. And when you hold your finger down, a bunch of new activities will become available that you can quickly access without having to either enter an app or go into an email or something like that.
Can you give me an example of what you mean?
Sure. So the first example that they gave during the presentation was the camera. You have the camera app icon that sits on your desktop. You can press and hold on that, and 3D touch will open up a list of short options for taking a picture. For example, if you want to take a selfie, you can hit the selfie button that's there, and it is faster to access that than it would be to open the app and flip the camera and get the picture ready to take the shot. Another example would be email. You can press and hold over an email as it sits in your inbox. Instead of having to open the email, you can just quickly glance at what's going on in the message and decide if you want to read further. And then multitasking, you know, where you're used to switching apps by double tapping on the home button. You'll be able to, you know, press and hold in the bottom left-hand corner and just kind of swipe from left to right, and you'll go to your previous application instead of having to double tap and thumb through to what it is that you wanted.
Why do they call it 3D touch?
Because they really like catchy names for things.
Okay.
It's not a new technology. You know, Android has had a version of it for a little while that is just press and hold.
Mm-hmm.
It's for the watch, they called it force touch, and it uses this this very realistic feeling response system that they call Taptics, where it's very similar to it's a high end version of the vibration sensor that everyone has in every phone that vibrates when something happens. This moves at significantly higher rates in order to generate that kind of click back. And one of the fascinating things about using it on a MacBook is when you tap, it legitimately feels like you are pushing a button, even though there's no button there to push. Like it feels almost like the trackpad is kind of ticking back at you, as though you pushed a key on a keyboard. And it's a fascinating sensation if you're not expecting it. And so that it's all of these kind of small things that have come together to interact with the interface in a way that they feel is, you know, a new dimension of interacting with things. And so that's why it has that name.
Interesting. I mean, because we've been talking lately about bringing back the keypads for that, how much people like that sensation. It's interesting they're using it in another, or it seems like they're getting that at Apple.
Yeah. So, you know, it should have some pretty interesting feedback for typing, where you have that kind of tactile response when you push a button or you do something like that. And that is, you know, a really great way of handling that. And for a bunch of people, that's probably going to be enough. You know, you'll be able to use that keyboard and maybe won't feel the need for an actual accessory that you stick onto your phone.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Russell Holley, contributing editor at Android Central. And we're talking about what's new with Apple. There was a big event last week. They rolled out a lot of their the iterations on their gadgets. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. All right. So you said the battery inside has been beefed up a little bit. Is that to handle these other changes?
Actually, curiously enough, the battery has gotten a little tiny bit smaller.
Oh, I thought
it is a 1,750 milliamp hour battery, as opposed to some of the battery sizes that we've seen before. It's not a significant change, and Apple claims that it's not going to have any noticeable change in battery life. You still get that 10 hours of constant use throughout a day.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you kind of have to make room somewhere, and they weren't changing the outside casing. So in order to make room for some of the extra stuff going on in the screen and the camera, the battery had to shrink just a little bit.
But they're saying we won't notice a difference.
That's what they're saying.
Hmm. Okay. I guess you'll let me know about that. What about the screen? How does the 6S compare to the 6?
You're going to notice very little as far as the screen quality difference between the two phones. And what you may notice, because there's more RAM, which means that things will be able to be stored in memory for longer. Switching back and forth between applications should be a little smoother, and things will you know, stick around a little longer if you're jumping between things. Web pages won't refresh quite as frequently because it'll all be stored. But the actual screen shouldn't change much.
And any good launch apps designed for 6S?
So they announced a couple of games that are going to be available, but nothing. Nothing that, you know, jumps in and really takes advantage of it that is wildly different from what you already have.
Okay. And in the new phones, Siri will always be on and listening for commands. Now, this has already been, Motorola has already been doing this, right?
So most of the Android phones have been doing this for a little while. Okay. What makes Motorola special is that it does it even when the screen is off. Whereas the other ones, you have to have the screen on, but you can have the screen on and be anywhere. And the previous version of Siri on the current generations of the iPhone, that always on mode only works when it's plugged into power.
Mm-hmm.
And now it will do that listening from any screen.
How do you feel about that?
I think it's great as long as you use it. I think it's something that can be really easily turned off if it's something that creeps you out a little bit. So it's one of those things that, you know, if you use Siri all the time and you do things like, you know, drive a car, then having access to that feature is really great. If you are the kind of person who has a bunch of Apple products in your home, and so your iPhone is connected to your home stereo system and all of these things, then being able to call out, you know, from across the room and play music on your speakers is a really huge deal for people who have setups like that. So I'm mostly ambivalent about it. I think that there's a group of people who hear that kind of thing and panic immediately because there's a microphone that's always listening. But it's not nearly as creepy as it sounds.
Is it storing what it hears?
Sure. I mean, it's not recording all the time. It's basically it has a pattern, which is your voice pattern, and it listens for that pattern. And when that pattern matches, then it turns the microphone on all the way and listens to whatever the command that comes next is. So it stores that little fragment, but it's not Apple doesn't have, you know, a hard drive somewhere of everything that was happening in your, you know, bedroom for the last 12 hours or anything like that.
Okay. Then no one will have heard me snoring.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. So here's the nitty gritty questions. When is it going to launch and how much is it going to cost?
So the prices are going to vary by carrier if you are getting them from Verizon or T-Mobile or anything like that. If you're getting them from Apple directly, then they start at $799, I think, for the 16-gigabyte version. I would really recommend that nobody ever, ever, ever buy the 16-gigabyte version of an iPhone because that's just not nearly enough storage, especially now that pictures are 12-megapixel. They are going to be significantly larger.
Hmm.
If you're planning on getting an iPhone, just understand that the 16 gigabyte version is really hard for, you know, kind of long-term use, especially now that you can do things like 4K video and pictures and games are always taking up more space. So it's something to keep in mind. But it should be available if you can pre-order it now and have it available to pick up next Friday. If you schedule an appointment at an Apple store, you can go at a predetermined time and pick it up, or you can order from a carrier and go and pick it up, or you can just have it shipped right to your house.
Any sense about how the carriers are changing their deals, their contracts with cell phone users, how that might affect the impact, how that might impact the demand from that?
Sure.
From
so I mean, a big focus from the carrier shifts right now is to try and separate the cost of a device from the cost of a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're seeing with a lot of that is, you know, focus on people who want to just be able to buy a device outright instead of, paying for the phone over a 2-year period or something like that. And in those cases, the more expensive your phone is, the harder it is for someone to say, okay, well, you know, I'll spend, you know, $800 or $900 upfront for this phone. And so a lot of those people are going to go back into these kind of payment plan setups anyway.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say that the carrier plans are different. I would say that they are organized in a way that is beneficial to people who know exactly what it is that they want.
Mm-hmm.
But for people who don't know exactly what it is that they want, I think it's deliberately more confusing in some cases.
Yeah. All right. Did you say how much is it going to cost, or did I just block that out?
So they start at $800.
Holy crap.
And they go up depending on the size of the storage you want. They go up. You can get a 16 gigabyte, a 64 gigabyte, or a 128 gigabyte. And unfortunately, the best one for most people is going to be the 64 gigabyte version, mm-hmm. which is another $100.
Hmm.
But you'll find payment plans are available through each one of the carriers. And Apple has a new payment plan system that they're doing where as long as you know for a fact that your next phone is going to be an iPhone, you are essentially renting a phone from Apple until the next year, and then you just trade it in for the new one.
I know we have a question coming in about the new iPhone, and we'll get that when it gets here, but let's move on to the iPad Pro. The iPad's been around for a while. Believe it or not, I've never had one.
iPads are one of those things that you either, you know, use all the time or don't ever use because they are, for most people, content consumption devices. You know, I had one for a while when I wasn't working from home because it was really great for watching movies or for reading books or something like that. They're really great for consuming content. And, you know, so I didn't need a full-size iPad. I jumped on with the iPad mini, mm-hmm. and that's always kind of been my favorite one. But there were a bunch of people who felt like the iPad was not big enough. They wanted something that was closer to a laptop size. And so they went with the iPad Pro, which was announced this past week. And it is a 13-inch iPad as opposed to the previous 9.7, I think, was the last iPad. And so it is laptop size. It has a special keyboard that it can dock into that makes it look very similar to a Microsoft Surface in the way that it functions. Mm. You know, separate keyboard that you can use if you actually want to go and do typing. It's designed for multitasking so that you can run two full-size iPad apps side by side on the screen. And if you really are into the iPad, you know, ecosystem and you enjoy that kind of content consumption setup, then you can get this larger version. They start, I think, around $1,000 for the kit that includes the keyboard. So they are really expensive.
Yeah.
When you can get decent laptops that weigh close, not quite as light, but close for, you know, usually noticeably less than that.
Okay, here's an email from Jessica in New Albany. She says, can you ask your guest if Apple is able to launch a, quote, swipe to text, end quote, function, such as the Android platform has?
So, I mean, there are virtual keyboards that are available third party that are not made by Apple that offer those exact same features. There was part of the last release. You can look, I think SwiftKey is a perfect example of that, you know, kind of input that you're looking for, where you can, you know, kind of trace along the keyboard instead of having to punch in the letters. And those are just apps that you install, and it replaces the Apple keyboard with those tracing keyboards.
Okay, well, I obviously spent way too much time on the iPhone 6S, so we've run out of time. But maybe we can continue our conversation next week, Russell?
Sounds like fun.
All righty, Russell Holley, contributing editor at Android Central. We'll continue talking about the new Apple iterations next week with him. In the meantime, thanks to the All-Site staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Shyla Knott, All-Site's interns Trent Lammers, Ryan McFadden, and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks for listening. This is All-Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.